Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, June 8th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Analysts Urge Caution During Oil Recovery. S&P Global Platts, Biggest Concern is Second Wave of Coronavirus Infections, by Mella McEwen. Crude prices have climbed back to nearly $40 a barrel. Energy demand is rebounding as vehicles return to the road and airplanes to the sky. Energy analysts say this is all good news, but they urge caution. We're not out of the woods yet, said Chris Midgley, global head of analytics at S&P Global Platts, during an online press briefing last week. There's real uncertainty around this recovery. While there is a V-shaped recovery in gasoline and a U-shaped recovery in jet fuel demand as some flights resume, the biggest concern is a secondary wave of infections, he said. He also cited the wave of infections in Southeast Asia, Africa, South America, and developing countries without extensive lockdowns or access to health care. There's also a terrible situation around the world with the protests and riots bringing people together in massive numbers at a time when we least want that, he said. That's raising the risk of a secondary wave of infections, and that means we're revising down our oil demand forecast by 3 million barrels. The roughly 14.5 million barrels in production cuts by members or the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and allied countries was a good strategy, Midgley said. Other companies and nations outside of OPEC are likely to stick with those production cuts. Companies like ConocoPhillips, Chevron, countries like Norway and Malaysia are committed to cuts, he said. Even if demand does return to near normal numbers, not all of the curtailed production will come back, said Shin Kim, head of oil supply and production analytics. In the U.S., 2.5 million barrels were shut in March and April, and only 1.5 million barrels will be back by August, she said. Shale is still on a decline track and will fall through mid-2020 because drilling rigs have come down 65%. Frack crews and completion crews have come down 85%, she said. We've lost so much activity in the U.S., it will take time and a lot of confidence to get companies to spend again and get production rates to flatten, let alone rise. What the company believes will happen with oil markets in the second half of 2020 into next year will depend on the actions of Saudi Arabia and other members of OPEC and Russia, she said. They can respond to market conditions much faster and in a bigger way than non-OPEC countries, she said. They don't want price levels so high they bring additional production back online, and more importantly, they don't want to overstimulate production, especially U.S. shale, so we don't get back into an oversupply situation, Kim said. The oil production cutbacks are having a marked impact on the natural gas market, especially the natural gas associated with crude oil production, said Midgley. He said 10 billion cubic feet of production has been lost. That's going to tighten the gas market in the U.S. significantly as we move toward the end of the year into next year, he said. We have to balance the market by either bringing more production online, for which we need higher prices, or balance demand, or by switching from natural gas back to coal. I think coal may get a bit of support at the end of this year and next year as coal moves back into the mix of power generation. We'll need more coal production and less coal exports, which will mean higher coal prices. Ira Joseph, head of Power Analytics, agreed, saying the company's outlook for natural gas is bullish. But it's definitely been positive for coal as well, at least temporarily. It's an odd situation where if natural gas prices get high enough and we're bullish on the price forecast, that opens the door for more coal burning, even if temporarily, during the November to March 2021 period. I don't think coal producers are appreciating the potential upside, at least temporarily, for coal burning. Rick Joswick, head of oil pricing and trade flow analytics, said the world has seen an unprecedented buildup of crude, crude products and natural gas liquid stocks to the tune of 1 billion barrels to date. We've never had that large a buildup before, he said. We were concerned production wouldn't slow quickly enough and stock levels would rise up to potential storage limits, which is 1.4 billion barrels. Luckily, people make the choice to cut back. They made the choice voluntarily. Even U.S. producers cut back voluntarily, even though prices were not at extremely low levels for the most part. We dodged the bullet there. We kept stocks lower than the limits. Prices did not have to get forced down into single-digit levels, which would have kept oil in the ground through price action. Now that recovery is beginning, we're starting to draw from storage, but it's a relatively flat peak, Joswick said. We have a lot of stock hanging over the market for the next few months, so we're not bullish on oil prices rising beyond where they are right now. This article is entitled, MISD Seeks Input on Another Calendar Option. District Sends Second Survey to Parents, Teachers, by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD's conversation with the community about the 2020-21 school calendar will continue another week. Superintendent Orlando Riddick stated in an email on Friday night that a second survey has been sent to parents and teachers based on input from our community that we heard when the first survey was introduced. The second survey includes intersessional calendar sample B, another option that allows for multiple weeks off in October, December, and March, along with a week off for Thanksgiving. As I heard from emails and conversations, I didn't want our community to think that we could limit options, Riddick wrote. This survey takes this feedback, which was not an option that our community had to decide on, with the other options. Thus, I wanted to provide the community an alternative to what was introduced that incorporated a traditional option and still centered on the opportunity to support the academic needs of our students. We'll need knowing that we will get a summer slide as well as COVID-19 slide with our students. The second intersessional option calls for the school to start on August 17th instead of August 3rd, as in the first intersessional option. The last day of school is still during the last week of June. There are four fewer holidays or students' days off compared to the first intersessional option. However, there are still the two full week periods, one in October and one in March, that can be used to provide additional academic support. According to the district's email to parents, during an intersession, students are on holiday unless he or she is not on track academically, or the district was required to close before these dates because of COVID-19. In this case, these intercession days would not be makeup days, would be makeup days, and not added to the end of the school year. The district also said students who desire academic enrichment could have an opportunity to attend intercession. The email to parents also noted that intersessional sample calendar B has 170 days of instruction compared to 175 for the first intersessional calendar. If the district is required to close because of coronavirus during on the schedule, that already had been approved. Makeup days would be added to the end of the school year. Depending on the timing of the school closure, that might not be the case with the intersessional calendar. With the fall coming quickly, knowing that the flu and COVID-19 have a potential impact, the need to build an adaptive calendar would utilize this time to gain days if closure occurred, Riddick wrote. The second survey would provide trustees more information to glean as data as they consider our recommendation. MISD board members already approved the 2021 calendar that calls for school to start on August 19th and end on May 28th. There are 11 holidays on, or students' days off on that calendar, not including a full week for Thanksgiving, 2 weeks for Christmas, and a week for spring break. The already approved calendar has 172 instructional days. During the May board meeting, MISD staff approached district leaders again with the intersessional calendar, which is being used in some districts around the state. Midland ISD leaders patterned their first calendar on the one used in Socorro ISD, which is in the El Paso area. Riddick said he would share information from the first survey with board members during a meeting on Wednesday. The second survey asked parents their child's school and grade, if they would choose a virtual learning option, if intersessional calendar sample B should be considered, if the first intersessional calendar should be considered, and if the calendar the board has already approved should be considered. Parents may provide comments on virtual learning and for each of the three calendars. On the questions for the intersessional calendars, answers provided are yes, no, and consider for the 2021-22 school year. For the calendar already approved, yes and no are the answers provided. Responses will be collected until 11:59 p.m. Friday. This article is entitled The Place to Be in 2021. Developers Submit Plans for Green Acres Project by Stuart Doreen. It'll be the old course that feels new. That is how a developer described the project to complete the to bring the Green Acres miniature golf course in East Midland back to life. Jeff Beard gave the Reporter Telegram a sneak peek of the plans that have been submitted to the City of Midland. Once permits are obtained, building and landscaping companies are ready to go, he said. Beard showed the Reporter Telegram a course that longtime members will remember. The 18-hole course has good bones, he said, so there won't be many changes to the layout. Holes like Country Mile, Roller Coaster, Ant Hill, Windmill, and Log Cabin will be restored, he said. There also are plans to install a more modern turf. Beard said in making the course more family-friendly, the following changes include ADA and stroller accessibility for the entire 18 holes, playground equipment within the course itself, climbing areas, slides, swings, a cargo net, and playgrounds will keep the little kids busy while the bigger kids work on their game. A new pond and new waterfall within a river that flows through the middle of the course. The drawings provided also showed other differences. A 3,750-square-foot building west of the course that will house an arcade, snack bar, and lounge. There will also be a porch and canopies around the building for a total of 6,200 square feet of entertainment space. The longer-term plan calls for the development of Phase 2, which includes a splash pad, open lawn area, stage-slash-outdoor movie screen area, and pavilions. Plans also call for planting 90 new trees on the property. Just like the course needs new life, so does much of the landscaping, Beard said. There are still some original trees out there, but a lot of them are in bad, he said. Companies playing a role in the Green Acres project include the building company Fairs from Seminole and Turf Specialties from Midland. Beard said it was important to use local or regional companies and people excited about the opportunity to be associated with the Green Acres project. What I did on landscapers was I called around to the big ones in town and basically kind of went with who we wanted based on how excited they sounded about it, Beard said. Midlanders responded to the news of Green Acres returning. Beard said the Green Acres Facebook page has seen activity whenever a post is made, even if it is not as regular as he would like. And the Reporter Telegram's coverage in May 2019 connected with thousands of readers. You feel a sense of duty to make sure that you do it right, Beard said. And so, while it's our project, it's really a community project, and it is important to make sure that the community is happy with what we're doing. We've worked through a lot of the details, and I think they'll really be pleased with it. It'll be the old course that feels new. With the nature of the construction and a project the size of Green Acres Rehab, Beard is hoping to open in early 2021. I just want to let people see it, so they can be excited about what's coming, Beard said. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled Guest View. $3 trillion in coronavirus aid isn't heading to hometown America. The coronavirus is wreaking havoc on small towns and cities across America. Once again, the federal government ignored people living outside the big cities. The $3 trillion in coronavirus aid isn't heading to hometown America, but to large municipalities. Direct relief was targeted only to communities of 500,000 people or more. That leaves out a lot of Americans. Congress can provide some relief if the political world cares to show that smaller cities and towns matter. A bipartisan Senate bill would send dollars to smaller communities cut out of funding through the already existing coronavirus relief law, ironically called the CARES Act, which provides relief only to large metropolitan areas. The State and Municipal Aid for Recovery and Transition, or SMART Act, would extend $500 billion in coronavirus relief to smaller cities, towns, and counties. Congress must act quickly. The coronavirus brought sudden disaster to communities across America. That, on top of the struggles many communities in Middle America already face, from high unemployment rates to dealing with the opioid crisis. While Pittsburgh and Allegheny County qualify for aid under the current coronavirus relief legislation, other communities in western Pennsylvania don't qualify for federal help. Even with the aid, Pittsburgh is struggling, and the city was forced into a hiring freeze. Many towns rely on income from a large festival or two every year that draws tourists into town. Those events are canceled. Local mom-and-pop motels face ruin with those cancellations that filled rooms for days or a week. Volunteer fire departments, which depend on funding from department-sponsored festivals or fundraising dinners, are being financially strangled by the impact of the virus. Middle America bears the brunt of the virus with little relief. City and town workers have been furloughed, including essential public safety providers, firefighters, and police. Ambulance services have been cut. There is no money to fix roads damaged by spring floods. The United States Conference of Mayors has compiled a database of the stunning impacts of the coronavirus crisis on cities across America. Budget cuts, layoffs and furloughs, shutdowns of public services, cancellation of planned infrastructure repairs. With so many people out of work, water and sewer bill payments lag, only adding to the struggles of smaller cities and towns. Before the advent of the coronavirus, thousands of small towns were struggling through the post-industrial era, barely making ends meet. Now the prospect for the future is bleak, with the actual or effective bankruptcy of cities, towns, and counties. Threatened are essential everyday services, from fixing a broken water main to repairing a pothole. Recovery funds must be provided to the many cities and counties not covered by the provisions of existing virus aid legislation. Congress must put some relief to Middle America. Passing the SMART Act would be a start. This column is from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This is the obituary column, Monday, June 8, 2020. Helen Scribner Hofs Littleton. Helen Scribner Hofs Littleton passed away peacefully at home with family on April 11, 2020. She was born on July 26, 1928 in San Antonio to Ferd and Esther Scribner. Shortly after, they moved to northern Michigan, where her father was with the Army Corps of Engineers. The Corps later relocated the family to the Texas coast. Helen was preceded in death by her parents, Ferd and Esther Scribner, her husband Jimmy, her son Graham Hofs, and her precious granddaughter Allison Littleton. Survivors include her son Mark Hofs, daughter Kathy Armstrong and husband Andrew, son Ferd Hofs and wife Cindy, daughter Julianne Martin and husband Phil, daughter-in-laws Michelle Hofs and Loy, and husband Tim Thompson. Many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The family will have a private graveside service on 11th of June in Burney, where Mom will be laid to rest with her Scribner family. the Reverend Irv Cutter from St. Luke's of San Antonio will be officiating. The family would like to say a deep heartfelt thank you to her caregivers from Comfort Keepers, Debbie, Tanya, Lupe, Jackie, Maggie, and Sue. Also thanks to Kindred Hospice. Special thanks to Dr. Carolina Ojeda Flores for her care and compassion. Memorials may be made to a charity of your choice. To leave condolences for the family, please visit www.ebensberger-fisher.com. Arrangements with Ebensberger Fisher Funeral Home of Burney, Texas.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, June 8th. Wonder Girls Camp Goes Virtual. The story was written by Michael Bauer. The Crisis Center of West Texas will continue to put on its annual Wonder Girls STEM Summer Camp, but it will be online due to the pandemic and social distancing guidelines. In the past, the in-person camp of STEM, arts, and empowerment for girls across West Texas would be held over a week, but this year, Crisis Center Services Director Elizabeth Texera said that they will be spreading the virtual camp throughout the month of July, with online events being offered on Wednesdays each week. This year's STEM camp will be held each Wednesday in July, from the 1st through the 29th. The camp is in its fourth year and is held for girls who will be entering grades 5 through 8 this fall. Quote, "Previously, we've hosted the week-long day camp in Odessa with the local colleges, and because of restrictions and safety, we've decided to take that online," Texera said. "Instead of a 5-day summer camp experience, we're releasing camp content via video on each Wednesday in July. It'll be 1 day worth of content each week that the Wonder Girls can go through at their own pace. Any needed materials for those videos will be distributing to the girls participating the week before camps," end quote. Those who sign up for the camp will get a link to each week's videos. Quote, "Those videos will be 2 workshops on science, technology, engineering, or math topics. There will be a video with fitness," Texera said. "There will be a video on a creative project and a couple about being empowered as a girl, whether that's exploration in a career path or information on healthy relationships. All of that will be available by video, and they can go through that content at their own pace. The next Wednesday, there will be a new set of videos," end quote. In the past, Texera said they usually had 60 participants, but with this year's camp being held online, they are hopeful of having more. Quote, "Because we're able to have a larger geographic region, and because people won't have to travel, and we're offering everything online, we're opening it up and we have funding to provide materials to 75 participants this year," end quote. At the moment, 35 have signed up, with registration opening up less than a week ago, according to Texera. Quote, "We serve a 9-county region at Crisis Center," Texera said, "from Ector County all the way to Winkler County. So we're hoping that some students in those counties that are further away, who usually can't travel to Odessa for the camp, can still engage in the camp this year," end quote. Applications are due by June 19th at 6 p.m. The Crisis Center of West Texas began resuming limited in-person services this week, but on an appointment-only basis. Even though the administrative office remains closed to walk-ins, those seeking counseling, case management, and other meetings with the Crisis Center staff can request face-to-face services. Quote, "If someone has never gotten service from us before, they can still make that appointment by calling our 24/7 hotline," Texera said. "But if someone is already working with a counselor or case manager, they can meet face-to-face by appointment or call their counselor or case manager to set that up." Social Distancing and Face Masks. This is a guest column written by Carol Cates, the Chief Nursing Officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center. I was sent a meme recently about face masks. It's a bit crude, but it gets the point across. It compares wearing a face mask in a respiratory illness pandemic to wearing pants. In the meme, it talks about how if we all ran around without pants and someone peed, lots of people would get wet. But if we all wear pants and someone pees, the chances are very high that only the person peeing gets wet. Face masks work basically the same way. If we all wear them, the chances of someone else getting coronavirus or any other respiratory illness from someone they encounter goes down dramatically. I know some people feel like wearing a mask should be a choice. I do not disagree with that idea. What I hope is that everyone's choice is to wear a face mask. This week, Lancet, a very old and respected professional medical journal, published a meta-analysis study about social distancing, face mask use, and eye protection use. In the world of research, meta-analysis studies are king. There are many kinds of studies published in the medical world. The ones that generate ideas are usually case studies. Case studies are when doctors or other scientists see something out of the ordinary in a very small group of people or just one person. They are basically for letting other scientists know, I saw this, this is what I did, and how it worked. You might try this if you see something similar, and we need to look deeper into this problem if many people are seeing the same issues. When that happens, where more research is needed because things are being seen in more than just a couple of people, bigger research studies are conducted. Those studies are called qualitative or quantitative studies in the research world, depending on how the research is done. But basically, in those studies, random groups of people are looked at and analysis done based on treatments versus people who didn't get the treatment. Those bigger studies are the ones where we figure out if treatments work or not. Drug trials are examples of these sorts of studies. Generally, with those studies, the less people know about who is getting the treatment versus not, and the more people who are included in the study, the more accurate the results are going to be. Meta-analysis studies are king because meta-analysis studies look at multiple qualitative and quantitative studies. Meta-analysis studies don't do the research, they analyze the research. They look at all of the research on a specific subject. For instance, a meta-analysis study is done looking at the effectiveness of drug X. There are three studies that have been done on drug X. Study 1 gave the drug to 100 men and said the drug was very effective. Study 2 gave the drug to 50 women and 50 men and said the drug showed moderate results. Study 3 gave the drug to 100 women and said the drug was ineffective. If you just look at an individual study, you might not be able to get the whole picture with drug X. If you are the doctor choosing to prescribe or not prescribe drug X, those conflicting studies, assuming you even saw all of them, can make it hard to decide how to best treat a patient. A meta-analysis would look at all of the studies and say drug X works well on men, but not so well on women. That is very simplified, but I hope it helps you understand how meta-analysis works. That is why this Lancet article is really a great thing. It shows that face masks, social distancing, and eye protection really do slow the spread of coronavirus. The researchers behind this meta-analysis looked at 172 studies from 16 countries across the globe. Six continents were represented in these studies, which means this is a huge amount of data looking at all sorts of people, men, women, old, young, and every color of the rainbow. They looked at the COVID-19 virus as well as the other two potentially fatal coronaviruses, the viruses that cause SARS and MERS. They found that transmission was 95% lower when people are at least a meter, a little more than 3 feet, than when people are close together. And the rates dropped even more the farther people were apart. That is why the 6 feet is a great distance to stay away from people if you can. You have less than a 95% chance of it being transmitted at that distance. It found that face masks, even single-layer fabric masks, drop the risk of infection without distancing by a huge percentage. Multiple-layer fabric masks dropped risk even more, and masks designed to filter out particles as tiny as viruses, like N95 masks, provided protection at a very high percentage. Eye protection also helps prevent transmission. When you combine social distancing with face masks and eye protection, the risk for infection falls very low, less than 1%. None of those things completely remove risk, likely because there is always the issue of user error. I know even wearing a mask every day I am at work, I still occasionally catch myself touching my face. It is a very hard habit to break. We can reopen. We can be outside in the world. This study proves we can do those things safely when people social distance as much as they can and wear face masks for those times they cannot. If you are not already wearing a face mask when you go out and about in the world, please consider doing so. As a final note, don't forget to wash your hands often because, as I said, touching your face is a hard habit to break. COVID-19 news. By the numbers. Ector County confirmed cases, 187. Ector County negative, 2,523 out of 2,813 tested, with 103 pending. 5 deaths. Midland County, 155 confirmed cases with 13 deaths. Texas, 74,978 confirmed cases with 1,255,899 tested. Total Texas deaths, 1,830. U.S. cases, 1,920,904 total confirmed cases, and 109,901 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us. or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Two new COVID-19 related deaths were reported Sunday morning at Medical Center Health System in Odessa. A news release detailed that one of the deaths was a 56-year-old man who went to the MCHS emergency room on June 6th with non-COVID-related symptoms. He tested positive for COVID-19 upon arrival and had previously tested positive on April 17th in Harris County. The second patient was a 62-year-old man who was admitted on May 24th. MCHS currently has 14 COVID-19 positive patients in-house. The critical care unit has 5 patients, 3 of which are intubated. There are 9 patients on 7 Central. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. Art Tales. Ellen Noel Art Museum, 4909 East University Boulevard, has scheduled Art Tales at 10 a.m. June 17th and June 24th. Art Tales is a story time followed by a fun art activity. 2 groups will be offered, one for ages 3 through 5, and one for ages 6 through 12. Art Tales will take place outside in the garden and will have a limited number of participants. Only 20 people will be allowed in the garden for this program. To enroll, or for more information, call 550-9696 or visit NowellArtMuseum.org. Clay Shoot Fundraiser. SHARE, which stands for Sharing Hands a Respite Experience, has scheduled Shooters That Share July 24th at Windwalker Farms, 2551 County Road 2801 near Stanton. Registration starts at 9 a.m. COVID protocol will be taken to assure everyone's safety. Six-man teams are $175 per shooter, lunches included. Sponsorships are available. To pre-register, sponsor, or for more information, call Rachel Reinert at 432-818-1257. Email rreinert@sharewtx.org or visit shootersthatshare.com.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, June 7th, 2020. Section A. Now is Midlanders' time to thrive together. A commentary by Patrick Payton, Midland Mayor. In this unique and challenging time, I'm thankful to be able to share with you where my mind and heart happen to be. There is a saying used often in society, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. I think we are supposed to take that to mean the world works because of tough people. I'm not a fan of the statement, for I think it falls short of the better principles that need to be considered for our time. There are a few phrases I keep coming back to that are becoming more important and relevant in these days. Blessed are the peacemakers, Jesus Christ. So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, Jesus Christ. Life's most persistent question is, what are you doing for others? Martin Luther King. Whether we face economic turmoil or virus or widespread response and discussion on race, if we will once again thrive, it will not be solely on the basis of rugged individualism and being tough. Rather, we will recover, thrive, and be even better only as we love and support one another toward change and growth in life and policy for the betterment of all. Our local economy will no doubt benefit from changes in global and national energy policy and practice. But our local economy will also depend on each one of us thinking twice about buying online and instead consider a local business we can support before we ask for Amazon to come to the door. We must choose to buy the basin as the Permian Basin gets back on its feet for a better future. We can buy locally to serve one another locally. And while we buy the basin, your city council will be working on every option available to keep more of your hard-earned dollars in your pocket, while at the same time, your hard-earned taxes are wisely and efficiently used for the growth and maintenance of necessary city services. Our local health will depend on how we take care of those around us, as well as taking care of ourselves. Throughout the COVID-19 virus challenge, the right thing to do has not changed. Whether personal hygiene, wearing a mask, or keeping proper distance, it has all circled back to taking care of your neighbor. Until we get to a long-term solution for this invisible enemy, we will still only thrive as we do the right thing for ourselves and the right thing for others. Our local community relations will only serve as a model for healing, growth, and progress if we keep pressing forward together in peace and for one another. Stephen Covey, Jr. has written, "With people, slow is fast, and fast is slow." I am encouraged by the way we have begun seeking to understand one another and our varying perspectives on life and culture. But it is only a beginning. It is very easy to think we already know the answers to the problems, but all too often we formulate answers without truly understanding the problem and the perspectives. We must keep moving forward with one another, forged in a bond of trust. We will heal and grow as we pursue peace, do what is right for one another, and yes, keep asking how we serve one another. Your city council and Midland Police Department are committed to becoming the best version of ourselves we can collectively become. It will take time, and yes, it will take love, but we will change, grow, and succeed together. Our local future will only truly be better if we never forget the lessons we are being forced to learn in this unique time in our shared history. We must never forget the reminder that work is vital, but family and community are essential. We must never forget the whole liberty and personal freedom is vital. Sacrifice for the good of others is essential. We must never forget that individual and community struggle is real, but that love never fails, always believes the best, forgives the most, and is essential. We will one day get back to the day-to-day discussion and habits of sports, concerts, picnics, property taxes, roads, and infrastructure. Indeed, that day will come sooner than we might even realize. We will look back on the spring of 2020 and refer to it as pre-COVID and post-COVID. But the tragedy will be if we look back on this time and find out, from the perspective of where we will be in 5 or 10 years, that we were not changed for the better by our trials and tests we shared together. It has been a dream of mine that one day we will be as famous for what we do above the ground as we are for what we do below the ground. I still believe in this dream, but from a different perspective. Now, I firmly believe how we support each other economically, physically, and most of all, relationally. That might just be what makes us the biggest, brightest star of Texas and a beacon for the nation. At the heart of our country, the great state of Texas and our special city, the hallmarks of liberty, freedom, and self-government are rooted in doing for others what we would want them to do for us, pursuing peace with one another at all costs, and always asking ourselves, how can we serve one another day by day? Open Carry Texas members protest outside Odessa Bar, by Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE, at MRT.com. More than 100 Second Amendment rights advocates with Open Carry Texas came to Odessa on Saturday to protest the arrests of 6 of its members last month. The protest took place at Big Daddy Zane's, the same bar where those 6 men were arrested for carrying guns where weapons are prohibited. Those in attendance were dressed in tactical gear and carrying rifles. They stayed in the parking lot outside the bar before continuing the protest outside the Ector County Sheriff's Office. The protest remained peaceful, despite an earlier video shared by Open Carry Texas Vice President David Ahmad, in which he said he was not going to allow the sheriff's office to arrest him if they tried to. ECSO sheriff's officers were not at the protest. Ahmad said in an interview he had spoken with Sheriff Mike Griffiths, and both had agreed to keep the demonstration peaceful. "I take him at his word. So far, he's kept his word, and I give him credit for that," Ahmad said. "What you see here are the good guys. We obey the law because we want to, because we are the good guys. We follow the law." In May, Big Daddy Zane's opened against Governor Greg Abbott's orders that bars were to remain closed at the time. 6 members of Open Carry Texas stood in a property adjacent to the bar, holding rifles, saying it was for a show of support for the bar owner, until sheriff's office deputies arrested the men, the bar owner, and another employee. Much debate ensued on social media over the legality of the charges against them. The men were charged with carrying weapons where prohibited. Griffiths cited the Texas Alcohol and Beverage Commission Code when explaining the charges, given the men were on a property adjacent to the bar. The Texas Penal Code defines a bar's premises as the building where the bar is located and does not include parking lots or nearby properties. That's for a liquor license. That's TABC code, Ahmad said. For the purpose of carrying a firearm, that's not the code that counts. He said in a video announcing the protest shared on Open Carry Texas' social media pages that he would not allow Griffiths to arrest him if the sheriff's office followed the same precedent set by the arrests in May, even if ECSO rolls in with the whole 2nd Armored Division. Ahmad responded to some interpretations that his words were a threat against Griffiths, saying, "Nowhere in there was there a threat. I'm not threatening to go to him and beat him up," he said. "I'm simply saying to him, if I haven't broken the law, I'm not supposed to get arrested. So I'm not getting arrested." He declined to say specifically how he would prevent the sheriff's office from arresting him, but said, "It means exactly what you think it means. If I'm not going to be arrested when I haven't broken the law," Ahmad said. "How far I have to go to do that is not up to me." Gabriel Ellison, owner of Big Daddy Zane's, spoke at Saturday's protest, thanking Open Carry Texas for supporting her. "My girls were going hungry," she said. "We were going to have to shut down the bar, and then I decided that the governor didn't have the right to do that, and the men decided to help me out." Ellison was arrested in May and charged with defying Abbott's orders, and one of her employees was charged with interfering with police duties. Ahmad said the charges against all who were arrested are currently in limbo. He said it is unclear if the Ector County District Attorney's Office will be pursuing the charges. "It is possible Open Carry Texas will hold more protests in Odessa," Ahmad said. He said he would like Griffiths to admit he made a mistake in arresting those people in May, apologize, and refund their bail bonds. MPD officer has connection with community. By Stuart Doreen, Storeen, at HearstNP.com. George Mitchell, it's important to have relationships with Southside residents. It's 10 p.m. last Sunday night, a protest unlike any Midland has experienced in at least a generation, isn't winding down but is changing locations. A vocal group with plenty left to say and frustration to burn has moved from Midland Park Mall to the intersection of Midkiff Road and the South Loop 250 Service Road. The protesters have taken their calls for justice to the streets, literally. It is at that intersection where they encounter three Midland police officers, including Sergeant Giovarsi Mitchell. One protester, in particular, decides to see what the 6'1", 280-pound Mitchell is about. Talking a big game about Mitchell being tough because of the badge he wears. It becomes obvious pretty quickly that the spirited protester picked the wrong man. As the back and forth caught on, the Reporter Telegram's Facebook Live shows George, as he is called by all who know him, has proven himself in the community, and as he later tells the newspaper, his shoulders are big enough to take the criticism. Amid the yelling, emotion, and profanity, George is capably holding his ground. Before anything else is said, another protester tells the brazen and, quite frankly, overmatched man that George is one I can vouch for, a nod to the connection George has with the community. Sergeant Mitchell embodies those characteristics that make us both law enforcer and counselor, guardian and mentor, Police Chief Seth Herman said later. He is utterly devoted to protecting those in his charge, both citizen and officer. This is his community. These citizens, his family. This job, his calling. George Mitchell is a man of Southeast Midland. He played basketball for Jack Stevenson at Midland High on the team that went to the state tournament in 1994. His college days started at Grambling State University, but after hearing of a shooting on campus, his mother, Carla Smith, of the True Light Christian Fellowship family, told him his days in Louisiana were numbered. He graduated from Texas Tech. George became a member of the Midland Police Department almost 20 years ago. He has been promoted to sergeant and works in the narcotics division. Gio has a love for the street. "That's why I'm a cop," Gio said. "There is nothing appealing about chasing murderers, drug dealers, and rapists. You have to have the love." He said that growing up, the southeast side of Midland was very rich in culture. His heroes were other African Americans, also from that part of town. He said he and his friends didn't have run-ins with police, but MPD officers such as Bernie Kraft, who were chasing people, but were still able to shake hands with residents at the time, had a positive impact on him. "Those are the relationships I have with the people on the southeast side," he said. "It's important to keep those. I want to be effective as a police officer. People in the community, they have my number." Assistant City Manager Morris Williams told the Reporter-Telegram that Gio has remained true to who he was. "That means staying true to both the community and the penal code. That explains being able to arrest his cousin, which Gio said he has done." "It didn't go well," he said. "I have wanted to be fair and effective." "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about but don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and don't look too good nor talk too wise." Carla said she sent her son a copy of the Kipling poem a couple of weeks ago before the protest in Midland. As she said, "It is a reminder to keep your head about you, and that isn't always easy to do the right thing." On May 31st, Midland police officers, including Gio, had to remember their training and exercise patience in the face of hundreds of emotional protesters throughout the evening. As Midlanders have seen across the nation, it didn't take much to set off a powder keg. That didn't happen in Midland. Still, it doesn't keep a mom from worrying about her son. Carla said she doesn't necessarily like the thought of her son wanting to become a police officer, but it is her responsibility to pray for his safety every day. She also said that her 44-year-old son, who is a father of three, judges an individual on the person he encounters, not on anything else. She said situations have to do with the people involved, what's in their hearts, and not by lumping people into the same pot. "You can't stereotype by social, economic, race, or culture," said Carla, whose husband is Roy Smith, pastor at True Light. "For us, it is about our own personal integrity. You have to live with yourself and decisions you make. The George Floyd issue, it hasn't happened here." What does Sergeant Mitchell think of the brutality that four police officers have been charged with committing against George Floyd on May 25th? "It's sickening. If you look at some of the things that happen, it's embarrassing," Gio said. "If an officer does something like in Minnesota, all are held accountable." Which brings us back to Sunday night. George said one reason he got out of his vehicle in the first place was the protesters were throwing things at it. Even in the face of frustration and the profanity, George said police still have to do their job, and that starts with protecting all involved. Midland police shut down the intersection that night. "The way it played out, it was beneficial for both sides," Gio said. "Most of the protesters were kids. We didn't want any harm to come to them. It can be a controlled frustration. In retrospect, the Southeast Midland man said he appreciated that the protests last week didn't get out of hand. He said issues such as those surrounding the George Floyd incident haven't happened here, and that MPD is doing the best we can to change the culture. He's done his best to teach our young to respect themselves and others, leading by example rather than directing from the podium, Herman said. His easygoing attitude creates a deceptively aloof persona that is contrary to his resolve and commitment. This presentation places others at ease and allows for the exchange of dialogue that, more often than not, diffuses tense situations before they become events. He is a credit to the department and to our city. Geo said change and a better connection with all residents in Midland require the community to meet the police in the middle. It requires the community and police department to work together. It has to be a cohesive effort, Geo said. The goal for Midland has to be better.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.